What's it mean? 11. That's your name? 11. Okay. Well, my name's Mike, short for Michael. Maybe we can call you L, short for 11.
The boys bring 11 back to Mike's basement, where they spend most of the episode debating what to do with her and keeping her hidden from the adults. 11 reveals that she has telekinetic powers, and someone bad and dangerous to her and others is chasing her. She also knows something of Will's location and status, but her communication is cryptic.
Sheriff Hopper and the Hawkins Police Department continue their search for Will, which leads them to a torn piece of fabric outside the Department of Energy laboratory, as well as discovery of Benny's body, which has been staged to look like a suicide. Interviewing Benny's friends reveals that he is last seen with a boy whose head was shaved, which may or may not be Will.
Joyce receives another mysterious garbled phone call she believes is from Will, before all the lights and sound in her house are activated, and some unseen force tries to push through her walls, terrifying her.
Jonathan starts his own investigation into his brother's disappearance, which leads him to investigate the woods where Will disappeared. He hears screaming, but finds only Nancy and Steve fooling around at Steve's parents' house. Jonathan secretly films them. When Nancy goes inside to make out with Steve, Barb is left alone and is attacked by the Demogorgon.
Welcome to Dungeons and Demogorgons, the officially unofficial podcast for Stranger Things on Netflix. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
This episode is called Chapter 2, The Weirdo on Maple Street. I really like the name of this one. It's obviously a play on A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Mm-hmm.
Very good 80s reference, 80s horror reference, which this is turning out to be.
Yeah.
This episode gets a lot freakier.
Yeah.
I really like this one. What do you think of it?
I thought it was great, too. Another one that moved really, really briskly and covered a surprising amount of ground. Like, when I was trying to write the synopsis and keep it short, it's like, man, this thing covered a lot of ground, I just said. Did I mention it covered a lot of ground?
It did, yeah.
And also did a lot, like, it even had time to go back and develop, like, a relationship between Will and his brother Jonathan and the relationship with their dad and reveal more of like Joyce's just maybe potentially disturbing backstory and like a lot of little touches in the, like, we found a lot about a Hopper,
mm-hmm.
And his background as a big city cop that was probably fleeing to Hawkins to get away from all that shit. And it is wrapped back up in it. It got a backstory about Eleven's life in the lab and still advanced the main plot. There's a very, very tightly, intricately plotted episode.
Yeah, and they do a lot. This is kind of the hallmark of this show. It does a lot with very little. So, like, those things that you're mentioning, like, those developments are kind of very small, like, one-off sentences or, like, a quick flashback to something that's grounded by, like, the current events of the episode. And I really like how they sort of tease everything. Right, they don't even just tease like, oh, here's the monster. We're not going to give you a great look at it. They do that, but then they also tease like, what is Elle's background? What is Hopper's background? What is the relationship between a potential relationship between Nancy and Hopper or Nancy and Lonnie? Like, it's so well crafted. I really like it.
And it's a lot of nonverbal stuff. Like Jonathan's riding in his car after having a bad experience at school where, you know, people kind of look down at him as a loser as he's trying to hang up posters to find his brother. And this song from The Clash comes on and his mind goes back to him trying to distract his brother from his dad and mom fighting as they're splitting up and disappointing them by not picking him up for a baseball game, which then... He never says this, but that makes him think because, you know, Will wanted a relationship with his dad in a way that, like, Jonathan was already over. Mm-hmm. Makes him think maybe he's hiding out at my dad's house. So he goes and meets his – it's like it all kind of goes together and they don't have to – there's no long dialogue like, hey, Mom, I'm going to school and I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do this. It's just, it's very elegant and, you know, rest on the performances – and this dialogue rather than a whole bunch of expository baloney. Now, it does feel like eventually they'll have to get to some exposition because they're not explaining shit.
No, they're not.
This girl's got magic powers. She grew up in a lab. She's calling the head research scientist Papa in one of these flashbacks. It's opening a lot of questions. There's slime pouring out of Joyce's sheds, walls.
They're unfolding a lot of new info on us. Let me ask you this. So watching this the first time through, there was a certain point, and I think it might have been around the end of this episode, beginning of next, where I felt like this thing with Elle not being able to really talk very much started to become almost like a, essentially like pumping the brakes on the plot. And I the second time through, I'm noticing it, but I never felt like it got in the way. I always felt like they did just enough. Like, mm-hmm. they had Elle say just enough to keep me on the hook and not think they're just doing this to keep the plot from... keep this from being a two-episode series.
I mean, they are. That's the whole, like, the, you know, the constant frustration of a show where things could get solved if people just talked.
Right.
Is still there, but, like, they've earned it because they show this little girl as this research animal that...
Yeah.
They haven't bothered to socialize her beyond what they need to do to get whatever they need from her. Like, they haven't taught her basic meanings of the word, like, friend.
Or promise, yeah.
Or things like promise and the fact that she doesn't understand that she should be ashamed of her naked body. Mm-hmm. In front of mixed sexes. That... It does, like, I feel like it's earned. It's kind of like, you know, Jodie Foster in that one movie where her and her sister were raised by wild animals and she had this her twin speak and all that. It's like, it's frustrating, but that's part of the premise.
Yeah.
So,
And they do just enough, like I said, but they also kind of, I like how they have three sort of separate, but interconnected investigations going, mm-hmm. and how the characters who are involved in those investigations don't quite understand how they connect.
Yeah.
Elle, it's interesting, I guess, the information that different people have, yes. right? Because Elle kind of understands what's going on here at the root of it.
Right.
She's unable to quite communicate it, and even if she could, she doesn't get what's happening with Will, really, because she doesn't understand what a friend is.
Right.
And then you've got, like, Hopper, who's doing his police investigation.
Uh-huh.
He thinks that he's stumbled onto the location of Will, but in actuality, it's Elle.
Yeah, that's going to lead him barking up the Elle tree.
Right, which pushes him towards Hawkins' laboratory. Right. Yeah,
and there's danger there.
And then you've got the other investigation, which is Joyce, kind of going at it from the supernatural, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
Following these clues that Hopper would never investigate.
Right, and you have all these people who are not being guarded at all about what they're talking about or how they're going mm-hmm. about their investigation, being secretly monitored by the fourth investigation, right. which is the laboratory, and they know everything.
They do.
And the stakes are super high because...
They know, like, almost too much. They're recording every phone call that goes on in this area.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Maybe that's why Will keeps destroying his mom's phone.
Yeah.
Stop buying phones. I'm trying. I'm trying to keep you safe. I thought that's great. And, you know, also, you know, Benny's murder last episode underscores, as Eleven does, as she points her imaginary finger guns at the kid's head, mm-hmm. like how much danger they're being put under. And I thought that Eleven's performance is really good in this episode, where she just weeps for no good reason a lot of times. But I think what you're supposed to understand is she is caught between self-preservation and wanting to be safe and also the knowledge that everything she does is putting these boys and their parents and everybody in immense danger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, she's just feeling very hopeless.
Yeah. I it would probably be cruel, but I think if I were Mike, I would need to do some experiments on Elle to figure out, like, just how small of a room you could put her in.
Sure, that's reasonable.
I mean, it's for the good of everyone, really.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's going to hurt temporarily, Elle, but it's like a Band-Aid. We got to keep you safe. We got to keep you hidden.
Couldn't you just, like...
Can I put you in, like, the shed out back?
Right, but couldn't you just ask her, like, look at this room. Would you feel safe?
But she can't tell me.
She can say yes or no. I think she understands the word safe.
She does. I'm not sure how she understands so much language.
But also, does she really know until she's experienced it? Maybe she needs to be locked in there.
I wouldn't trust her until I've observed her.
It's science demands that we be sure.
It's for the greater good.
I liked all the kid... Like, again, all the kid stuff is really great because this all makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, their initial plan they came up with, which is like, hey... We don't want to be busted by going outside in the cold and wet looking for our friend Will, but we've got this little girl who needs help. Oh, I know. We'll just put her up for the night. I'll shove some waffles in my pockets and feed her.
Mm-hmm.
Get her back from school. I'll just lead her around, have her ring the front doorbell, and then it'll just be like, it's mom's problem. She'll know exactly what to do. And the kids are like, oh, yeah, this is really smart. It backfires when, you know, Elle doesn't want to do that because of the danger, and then but then there's this tension between the boys, but the complication is that while Will was showing around her house, they find this picture of them, all four of them, competing in a science fair, which, mm-hmm. by the way, what fucking school system allows you to just squat up and do a science fair?
I was always privy to the science fair duo.
You buddied up with another kid?
Yeah, you had a partner for those. For, like, basically all your projects.
Huh. No, it was always a solo affair.
Huh.
Did you know in my son's school district that school science fairs are voluntary?
That sounds wrong.
They're not
compulsory.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would never have done science fair projects if I didn't have to.
Science is optional. if you want it, but if not, you can just kind of safely ignore it. I don't know what kind of messages to sending out to our nation's youth.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of things make a lot of sense. But yeah, and then the reveal of, like, it's, again, it all makes sense within the show logic, where the kids are, like, you know, starting to be, you know, Lucas is getting pushy about, hey, you know, you gotta, well, if this is true that you know where Will's at, then you better spill the beans. And then when she won't, he goes to tell, you know, Will's mom, or no, I'm sorry, Mike's mom. Mm-hmm. She slams the door in his face with her mind powers.
Yeah.
Nose starts bleeding.
Yeah, that was not good.
That makes it so, like, we're talking last episode how the reason we think that maybe the kids can stand a chance against the forces of Raidus is because they've got someone with a superpower, but mm-hmm. we now see that there's some kind of limit to that. Like, yeah. that it seems like using her power in any kind of way is damaging her.
Yoda's nose never bled.
No.
I didn't see that in Star Wars.
I never saw Yoda try to slam a door.
No, he could have, though. He's a notorious door slammer.
Is he?
Yeah.
But so that's a problem. That's a problem if you're 11.
It is. I really like the job they did, though, of showing, I guess, a little bit more background on Elle, where she comes from, why she's sort of the way she is.
Right.
Putting her in that closet for, like I said, current events reasons made a lot of sense. It was very similar to the thing they did with Jonathan and Will.
And I was also thinking that with, like, Lucas and Dylan and all the... Well, it's not Dylan.
Dustin. Yeah.
That a lesser show would just have the kids be credulous. Like, oh, of course she knows Will and all, and no one would ask the smart questions. Like, she's just bullshitting us.
Mm-hmm.
But she demonstrates her power on several occasions. She slams the door, and she's also able to intuit that Will's avatar in the D&D game is the wizard, and she's then able to use that, you know, all of her communication is very cryptic. Like, she grabs Will, and, you know, they're essentially treating her like an Ouija board, and she flips her D&D board over, and she puts the wizard on the upside down board game table.
Yeah.
What the hell does that mean? And who is...
Yeah.
Is he running from the bad men? And then she puts the Demogorgon on the table.
Uh-huh.
So how does she know this? Did she, like, you know, we...
Yeah, what's her connection to this weird stuff that's happening in Hawkins, right?
Right.
Because we know that she escaped from the facility at the same time that whatever it is got the guy in the elevator at the very beginning.
Yeah.
So what exactly is her connection to it? I'm not sure.
Let's talk about Joyce a little bit and Sheriff Hopper, because their plots are kind of intertwined this episode. One of Hopper's deputies asserts, or maybe questioningly asserts, that they had a relationship.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe they did, because...
There's some weird... Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hopper's oddly deferential towards her. Like, he clearly thinks when, you know, like that she's crazy. And she does this crazy person thing where... You know, she says, I got this phone call, and it sparked my ear, and it had to be Will. And he's like, well, yeah. Or it could have been the electrical storms that were going through the area. She's like, what do you think, I'm making it up? And he's like, no, I'm giving an alternate explanations for the facts you're giving me, which I believe.
Yeah.
But he's still, like, you know, when he's talking about this with his deputies, they're all like, well, she's already a few steps from the edge anyway. And he's like, you know, shut up. Have some class. So
yeah,
maybe there's something
and
there.
Jonathan's dad kind of has a problem with Hopper. Like,
there
he knows
was,
him,
right? Is Hopper still running that town, that shithole?
Yeah. And then Joyce also, it's weird to me because she wants to follow up all these leads, right? But when Hopper suggests, I'm going to see Lonnie myself,
right.
She's like, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
Which is odd.
Well, that's a more of like last episode when she finally got the cop out to investigate. And he starts investigating. She's like, no, don't talk. Like,
yeah, don't look in the shed.
Yeah, let the people do their job, Joyce.
And then Lonnie also mentioned something about maybe I'm not the asshole. Like potentially there was a relationship between Hopper and Joyce. And that's kind of what broke them up or something.
It could be, but
I... Or maybe like that was payback for all Lonnie's cheating. He seems like a shitbag, but...
He seems like a shitbag, and also I've got my own personal knowledge. I've seen several divorced families where the dad kind of takes off, and he's always got this, like, well, if it wasn't for your mom, we'd be able to spend more time together. And it's all bullshit, because if you wanted to spend time, you'd find a way.
Well, there's always finger-pointing from both sides. Right. And trying to figure out who's...
And when you're a third party on the outside, and you're seeing it through the lens of the kids, it's really impossible to know. But I feel like you're... I feel like that they're... Yeah, you might be right about the cheating, but I also think he's a dirtbag because he's...
Sure.
Like, here's the thing why he's a dirtbag. His kid's missing, and he is not part of the search party.
Yeah.
He has not called. He's not cooperating with... manifestly doesn't give a shit.
And he's always, in this episode, he's like, oh yeah, that kid's shit at taking care of himself. I just thought he ran away and he was missing.
Right.
Well, if he's fucking lost and he's shit at taking care of himself, you should be worried.
Yeah, yeah. So it seems like he's got his array of excuses to let himself off the hook, but...
Yeah. And the person who's more affected by this whole thing is Hopper.
Uh-huh.
Like, you get a couple of scenes of him, like... being disturbed that, A, his friends are being killed,
right,
and also being really worried about Will. Like, he's out on his patio or his deck or whatever, drinking beer, popping pills, and smoking cigarettes in the middle of the night, just being kept awake by this.
Yeah, and, like, you know, you're getting this backstory of him, like we mentioned, being a big city cop, and he's trying to flee to the rural area where there hasn't been a disappearance for... you know, 7 years, and there hasn't been a suicide for like 20, and now he's got it happening back to back, and he thinks like maybe he's cursed, that he's haunted by these things, like maybe he's the one that's brought it. And I thought that was they paint this guy as such just a cad,
yeah,
and now they're like painting him with a little bit deeper hues here, which I enjoyed.
Yeah, he could be. Be haunted by his past in some way?
I mean, he kind of looked... Like, I felt like in this episode, there's a couple. Like, Jonathan and Hopper look like they just got done storming the beach of Normandy.
Right.
Like, they got they got resting thousand-yard stares.
Uh-huh.
And it's really effective. And also,
which really helps when you're using a telephoto lens.
Yeah. And it made me feel bad for, like, Jonathan because, like, he's clearly an outcast. Like... the shit going down between his mom and his dad and the fact that his mom might be a few screws loose has made him into this kind of pariah at school.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, his mom's very poor.
But she has two cars. I don't know about that.
Maybe Jonathan works too. I'm just saying
that
if you look at his clothes, they're out of date compared to the other kids at school, and they're also very worn.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, they got two cars. One of her mom's is a Ford, like a Gremlin copy.
Oh, boy.
A Ford version of a Gremlin. It's not a great car.
Yeah.
His dad's got an awesome car, though.
Yeah, his dad's got a sweet car.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
But yeah, they kind of show the different social strata in like the community and the store, like, you know, they're in the school, like, you know, Joyce, her family's very poor. Mm-hmm. Mike's family is kind of solidly middle class, and, you know, Mike could probably be a popular, like, Nancy's trying to make that jump to being a popular kid.
Yeah.
Because she's dressing smart and she's pretty and, you know, she's not poor.
But she's got Barb dragging
her
down.
She's got Barb dragging her down. Is Barb dragging her down? Like, how much of Barb is genuine concern? How much is jealousy?
Oh, I really feel the genuine concern from Barb.
Yeah, because,
like, she thinks she's doing things that are dangerous.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I don't totally disagree with.
Yeah, you go from not drinking at all to shotgunning beers at this party.
Yeah, and then you're going upstairs with Steve.
And going upstairs with Steve.
I wouldn't go upstairs with Steve.
Like, that's the thing is, like, I don't think, and also they're starting to lie to their parents. And that's the thing, yep. Like, I don't think, it's weird because it doesn't seem like Nancy's being honest with anyone. Her friends, her family, herself. Because she scoffs at the whole suggestion. Is like, oh, he just wants in your pants. Yet she falls in the pool, and now she's taking her clothes off and making out with Steve.
Yeah, she wore a new bra. She knew what she was there for.
She wore, like, Barb's very perceptive. Like, why do you have a new bra on?
Yeah.
Like, why would she, you know, maybe it's just because she wanted to feel confident and sexy for herself.
Okay.
I can feel like it's, like, you know, and Barb feels like she's going to be left behind, and she is.
Literally at this point she's gone at the end of this episode. The what I'm going to call the Demogorgon gets her.
Yeah,
I guess.
And
so
we got a good look at the Demogorgon's head for a few frames. It looks like a vaguely humanoid body with, like, an out of control Blade 3 vampire head.
Yeah,
it's like, imagine, like you know, the three part jaw, like if you just clone that in Photoshop and put it on top, it's like,
yep,
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like a flower with teeth opening up. A lotus blossom with teeth.
Yeah.
Unsettling. Unsettling. I like there's a lot of other scenes that were not... Like, you could argue they didn't even need to be part of the episode, but they add depth to the character. Like, Joyce going to her boss, Donald, and begging for an advance. And he's like, it's like, oh, yeah, sure. And he starts, and she's like, oh, I need 2 weeks because she's trying to replace her phone and do all this. And he starts balking because, like, hey, I'm having to cover. And she's like, look, I've been here for 10 years. I've never called in sick. I've worked Christmases and New Year's and nights and weekends. And I need you to fucking cut me to slack.
Yeah.
And he does. Like, she browbeats him into doing it. But then she demands the extra pack of camels at the end.
Right.
Which is a nice – like, again, like, I didn't need to see her scrape money together to get this new phone.
Uh-huh.
Especially as much time as they spent with it. But it shows – I mean, it did a couple things. Like, you might assume that maybe she's just, like, completely shiftless, but she's held down however crazy you think she is, she's held down and been very diligent about keeping her family afloat for over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just dismiss her as some kind of crazy cat lady out in the woods. Not totally, anyway.
It struck me very much as, like, somebody goes into a gas station intent on robbing the place, and they get into it, and they realize, oh, this is working. Mm-hmm. I might as well press my luck here.
Yeah.
Give me the cigarettes, too.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was with her until that moment, and then I'm like,
yeah.
I don't know, lady.
You just gave up the moral high ground,
yeah.
Joyce. I also thought it was interesting the kids are, like, so worried about their parents' reaction that they're lying to them, which is, it's like, yeah, I don't know how you keep a kid from doing that. But then
it's so completely an 11-year-old thought, though.
Yeah. And, like, you know, like, I'm more afraid of my parents punishing me than I am of getting eaten by a demogorgon, I guess, or shot by a government goon. But, like, his mom sits him down and it's because he's acting weird because he's hiding 11. And she's like, you know, you've been through a lot with Will's disappearance, and you can tell me everything, and you don't have to hide. And I felt like he maybe even got the things like, oh, I could actually push my luck a lot more than I am. Like, I could be like, oh, Mom, I'm an emotional wreck. I can't go to school today. And then he'll use that time to hang out with 11 and try to solve the case. But I thought that was that was pretty good, too.
I got to say, episode 2, Dustin is still the best. Dustin, by
I'm
far.
Lucas,
like,
guy. Lucas.
Dustin is leading the pack. With just the way he describes 11 getting naked. Like, it's hilarious.
He's funny, but Lucas is the backbone of the group, man.
Oh,
he's
for sure, yeah.
He's the pragmatist. He's always saying...
Dustin's a little scared of the situation, but...
Yeah, like, I feel like Lucas is... Who's the leader? Like, they want
it's
me
tough
to
say,
They
yeah.
want me to say Mike is the leader, but maybe he's the Kirk, Lucas is the Spock, and Dustin is the McCoy.
Okay.
Dustin's the one that's always making the cracks about your cold-blooded Vulcan blood,
right.
You know, jokes about teleporters, and Kirk's always trying to follow his heart, and Spock's reminding everybody, like, look, fuckers, can't we be logical about this?
Yeah, that makes
Spock
a lot
was
of
always
sense.
My favorite of the triumvirate, so maybe that's why I'm a Lucas guy. You're a McCoy guy?
No, I wouldn't label myself
a
McCoy guy. No, I'm more of a Spock guy, too, or actually a Kirk guy.
It's an imperfect analogy because in this one, like, McCoy would have to have a bit of a Rodney Dangerfield flair to him, which is kind of absent in DeForest Kelly's performance.
Yeah.
What else are we missing here for this episode?
Not too much else.
I mean, there's just so many questions at the end of this episode about, like, what is going... Is it really Will trying to... get a hold of her? What is going on with the lights and the music? What the hell is trying to push through that wall, which is a really creepy effect? What is 11 trying to tell them about the Demogorgon and where Will is?
What's the connection of this supernatural force to electricity? Like, that's a question I have.
Yeah, and it's not just purely supernatural, because we see these scientists in this chemical gear show up and are, like, doing this investigation and finding this goo. Like... It's supernatural, metaphysical, but there's also science behind it.
Yeah.
It's not completely Dungeons and Dragons at this point.
And I guess I like Joyce's character a lot, because she may be freaking out and she may be following these leads that no one will believe, but, like, She's also determined to find Will at any cost, right? The idea that she would be so freaked out by this thing that she runs out of her house, essentially screaming, gets in her car, and she's prepared to drive away, but then she realizes, no, this might be the thing that helps me find Will. I need to go back inside.
Yeah.
That gives me a lot of, I guess, respect for her as a mother and a character.
Yeah, and the other thing I had in my notes I forgot to mention is this element of Cooper's being, or Sheriff Hopper.
Mm-hmm. Hanging with Mr. Hopper.
Hanging with Sheriff Hopper. That it's not just that he ran away from the crime of the big city, but also he points out, like, yeah, it's not my first time investigated disappearance, but, like, that I always dealt with strangers. Like, you come in and, like, you know, other than your empathy for people, it's like it's the strangers and you're trying to solve this crime. Now you're talking about a friend of yours who's committed suicide or a family that you're close to has lost a kid. And, like, you know, he went out here to get away from that stuff, and now he's finding a more intense version of it. And the irony of that.
Yeah, they're really leaning into that idea of, like, this sort of small-town life and the connections that people have in that. And I'm wondering if Stranger Things isn't part of that. You know, not just strange from a, whoa, I can't believe what's happening perspective, but, like, literally, like, getting to know people and having these attachments to people. Like, everything seems to be getting stranger and stranger in this show, but these people seem to be coming more and more together with Hopper and Joyce and all, like, Eleven and Mike and all of them.
Yeah, and you're also, like, the other question is, you know, Nance is with this Steve guy who, again, not done anything to really earn my hatred, other than smoking, underage drinking, and having a criminal hairstyle.
Oh, come, we've all been there.
But you know, there's a little sympathy between Nance and Jonathan. And then also Jonathan act. Okay, I like Jonathan out in the woods trying to investigate his brother's missing, his disappearance. But then he goes to find and he investigates the screaming, finds it's just a, you know, people horsing around the pool. Starts photographing people in their house. Like,
yeah,
that's the kind of creepy Steve behavior I want to hate Steve for, and he's not displaying. And now Jonathan, who like, I want to feel sorry for, is being the fucking creep that got it. Like, what the hell is going through his head?
That's a real good question. I don't know if he intends to, like, blackmail Steve, but he would also have to blackmail Nancy at the same time.
Yeah,
right?
That's what I'm saying. Like, it doesn't, like, and also, I don't think, have they hinted that there was a mutual attraction there before? So, like, why would he feel entitled? Why would he want to blackmail Steve?
Right.
I mean, other than being kind of picked on and looked down on and low key bullied, that plot doesn't make a lot of sense. It seemed to came out, and I'm thinking, like, okay.
Yeah.
Well, he's going to capture Barb's disappearance, and that's going to be the piece that they need to put their... But then he runs out of film as the Demogorgon jump scares her, so...
He doesn't get any of it.
Doesn't get any of that shit. So what is going to be the use of all this?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Clearly,
he saw something, though, right? Or he didn't even see it. He saw her sitting on the diving board, and then he looked down to fill his camera again, and he looks up, and she's gone.
It's unclear to me what he saw. Like, did he see, like, a flash of light? Did he see the Demogorgon standing, and then they disappeared?
Did the pool lights turn on and off? Like,
yeah, I mean, he should have seen that, because the pool lights blinking on and off was a thing that actually happened. I would think that would catch your eye, but I don't know. Maybe he just doesn't know what creepy behavior is, because his dad's a creep, and his dad's girlfriend's a creep, because she's all like, oh, your underage son, I might break up with you and date him. Like, the fuck?
He's miscalibrated a lot, like Elle is.
Yeah.
Like, I'll just take all my clothes off here. This is normal.
Right. I'll take pictures of my friends naked for jerking off. I don't know. I don't know. They weren't like sexy or salacious photos.
No.
It was just.
They were blackmail photos. Like, those are teenage blackmail photos. But I don't know.
He didn't catch him drinking or doing. Like, they were just having fun beside the pool.
With,
like,
no adults.
But
while the parents are out of town.
Yeah, maybe that's 1983 blackmail material. I was still wearing underoos and playing Star Wars. I can commentary on the state of blackmail in the 1980s.
I can comment on the state of wood paneling, and it is strong.
Wood paneling.
Like, they're great basement for Mike. Great yep. 80s basement.
Yeah, the Mike's basement is like I was kind of envious of it because that's what I'm thinking, like, huh. In what world could you put a girl down in the basement and, like, throw a sheet over the table and know that your mom's not going to go down there to do laundry or whatever and get busted? But then I was looking around and I was like, this is just their playground, man.
Right.
It's got a permanent D&D setup and there's, like, a permanent fort going on. Like, that's the kid zone.
No, my cousins had a basement exactly like this.
Huh.
Exactly. Like, you got the staircase leading down to it. It's all wood paneling. It's this big open area.
Yeah.
It just has, like, toy chests and bullshit for the kids everywhere.
You ever think, do you ever think that wood paneling will come back? Because here's the thing about wood paneling.
See, I would love to have a basement that is just like that.
Yeah. Yeah,
because it's a nostalgic thing for me. So
I feel like wood paneling is like warm and natural in a way, like avocado green appliances and Harvest Gold, all that shit. Can go fuck itself, but like wood paneling, I don't know. I feel like wood paneling is going to be like wood hardwood floors. Like that's what we started with, and then we got the area rugs, and it's like, you know what's cool? Wall to wall shag carpeting,
yeah,
and central vacuum sweepers, and then like after the shag carpeting wore out, it's like rip it off. Look, we got these beautiful who knew there was hardwood floors under all these? Like that's
the thing in the 80s, I guess, just the wood moved from the floor to the walls,
right?
And we replaced that with carpet. Yeah,
it's weird because like
and now it's going back
wallpaper.
The other way. When are we going to start putting carpet on walls?
I guess that would be because that.
I feel like the 70s might have done that.
I cursed the 90s because every house I've ever moved into has had significant wallpaper.
Oh yeah,
wallpaper is just the worst now. You can't have wallpaper.
Nope.
You got to rip it down and fix up the sheetrock and paint it. And I don't know. Wood paneling though,
and it's all over the laboratory.
And never have I peeled off wallpaper and like, oh my god, look at these hardwood walls.
Right. The shiplap.
Can you believe
everywhere.
What's underneath here?
I don't think it's ever coming back on cars. That's the one place where wood paneling just doesn't belong.
Yeah, I thought the same thing about dashboards, but I saw a couple of dashboards recently that burl wood, and I'm like, who the fuck thought this luxury?
Yeah. Like brand new cars too.
I need rainforest wood up in my 2017 sleek exotic battery driven dashboard. What the fuck?
Right.
I don't know. Carbon fiber is kind of ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of very specific applications, and the vinyl shit just gets old. So
carbon fiber floors. That's the
carbon
next.
Fiber wood.
Yeah.
Wood fiber is what we need.
Thanks for listening to our season one coverage of Stranger Things. If you like what you hear and want more, check out all of our television, movie, and pop culture content on baldmove.com. If you'd like to help support our podcast and get a ton of bonus content and features, check out club.baldmove.com. We'll also be taking feedback during our upcoming Season 1 wrap-up podcast, so send that in to strangerthings@baldmove.com. You can also discuss this with your fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.